You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Andrew Child, and welcome to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast, a companion piece to the Routledge Press publication 50 Key Stage Musicals, which is available for purchase by going to Routledge.com or clicking the link below in today's show description. Today's episode focuses on Chapter 12, The Threepenny Opera, and with us today is author of that chapter, Lauren T. Mack. Lauren is a Brooklyn-based actor and writer who has appeared on stage in New York at the York Theater, New York Fringe Festival, IRT, the PIT, and on stages throughout the U.S. and France. Lauren's voiceover work ranges from Ford Motors to audio play meditations with Full Metal Workshop. Lauren also produces award-winning indie films such as Cat Planet, and recently appeared in Velour, which was an official 2020 selection for Queer XFF. Lauren teaches acting at New York Film Academy and is a proud member of Actors Equity and a key with Ring of Keys. And you can read more about Lauren at laurentmack.com. Lauren, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So I loved your chapter on Threepenny Opera. And I'd love to sort of start chatting today. For those who maybe haven't gotten their hands on the book yet, what makes The Threepenny Opera a key musical in musical theater history?
I mean, so many reasons. I was so excited when I got to write about this chapter because for me as like a musical theater student growing up, I always, of course you love Oklahoma, you love, Brigadoon, you love these shows, but you also kind of find yourself, and I know there are musical theater students listening to this right now who are like, yeah, but like, where's all the Urinetowns at? You know, like, why isn't there more of that? Where is the stuff that we can actually sink our teeth into intellectually? And, you know, and Threepenny Opera really shifted that conversation. It really, you know, if you think about what was popular in the 50s, musicals wise, you're looking at King and I, you know, you're looking at Guys and Dolls. These are fairly formulaic shows, right? You know, there's not a lot of bucking of social norms, you know. But a lot of the, you know, all the legit shows were uptown, right? All of the legit shows were in you know, Times Square, 42nd Street. That was where, you know, a hit show would be. And this show had its home at the Theatre de Lys, which is in Greenwich Village. And the two producers were unknowns, you know, Carmen Capalbo and Stanley Chase. They crowdfunded the initial run for $10K, for a short-term lease, you know, all of their friends just put in. And, you know, it was anything, and this was sort of something that was starting to happen at this time, right? It's what we now, looking back, refer to as the off-Broadway movement. But at the time, we, you know, no one knew that that's what it was, right? It was just any production or theater company that was kind of deemed too radical or strange for a Broadway audience would find a home in a cafe downtown or a church basement or a music venue. You know, they were going wherever they could to make their work happen. So, you know, and this this was also an incredibly accessible show. The best seats in the house were $3.60.
Wow.
You know, and they had to do that because to convince a Broadway audience or a Broadway critic to come all the way downtown, which now we laugh about because, you know, half of us live in Brooklyn, but like to come all the way down there was a huge deal, especially because that was like sort of the hot house where the countercultural movement was happening in the 50s, right? You had beatniks down there. Jackson Pollock was doing his work down there. Jack Kerouac, Merce Cunningham. You know, this was where the new stuff was happening. So Threepenny found its home there because it was kind of, it got a lot of great response from producers initially, but everything kind of petered out. And it's still a very unique musical. There's dissonance in the chords, you know, it's not always like a, like, oh, I'm going to relax and put on Threepenny Opera.
Oh,
like,
God, no. Oh,
it
God,
attacks
no.
You,
yeah.
Man. It,
yeah.
You know, and that's the heart of the piece, right? Is it's demanding you pay attention. You know, and you can hear and see this influence in later musicals like Cabaret, like Company, like Pippin, you know. It was really sort of the face of this, you know, trend that it started for musicals to buck a formulaic ending, to acknowledge the audience and kind of slyly wink, you know. And to address like really heavy and salacious topics like, you know, prostitution, the hero's a murderer, systemic inequity, you know, I mean,
right.
These were not things you did at that time in a musical.
Do you think that the unique location of this show and sort of positing Bertolt Brecht among those names that you just listed who were kind of having their own movement downtown, did that increase this show's success? Did that make this show something that it wouldn't have been had it opened in a more mainstream venue?
Yeah, interesting you say that. I think, yes, I think that the success came from, you know, and this was something Bertolt Brecht would be very proud of, that it was the people, you know, it wasn't the elites that made this popular, you know.
Okay, yeah.
But, you know, funnily enough, at this time, the production in the United States, which was not the first production of Threepenny, the first one was in Berlin in the 20s. He was actually in East Germany at this time. He wasn't really involved with the American production. He gave his sign off for the translation, but the people who were stateside were Lotte Lenya and Kurt Weill. Kurt Weill was the composer. Lotte Lenya had famously played Pirate Jenny and was his wife, and after he passed, kind of the guardian of his estate and his work. So those were the folks, you know, so they were, you know, European refugees themselves. So at first, the audiences that were coming in were European refugees from World War II, sort of nostalgic for, you know, the sound of the time before the war, because this, you know, premiered in 1929 in Berlin. You know, but then the countercultural moment happened. And I really think that you can't leave politics out of this show, because the reception in Berlin, you know, was, you know, pretty clearly delineated along people along the lines of ideology, whether you were more capitalist and on the side of the bourgeoisie, or if you were more a socialist, right? And then we have this show happen again in the 50s in the United States, and what's happening right then? The McCarthy hearings, right? So there is yet again a division between, you know, the younger generation, you know, the beatniks, the counterculturals, the revolutionaries, you know, who were deeply attracted to this work. And it did help that at this time, you know, both Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht were subpoenaed by the, you know, House of Un-American Activities Committee to speak. And that added to their notoriety, I think.
So do you think that the American market sort of had a place for this show in the 50s, you feel like, because of what was going on in the world?
See, I think it didn't. I think it did it by the skin of its teeth. It really wasn't popular with, you know, the if it had gotten a space uptown, I don't know that it would have done very well.
Interesting.
You know, I think it was really that geographic positioning, because it did have, you know, so Mark Blitzstein, who was the translator of the lyrics and a brilliant, you know, writer in his own right. He had like a couple of, you know, concerts to kind of garner some interest, try things out. And Kurt List, who was a Viennese-born music critic, so he's from Austria, came to the United States at some point during the war, right? He called the early production, quote, a piece of anti-capitalist propaganda which exalts anarchical gangsterism and prostitution over democratic law and order.
I mean, is he wrong?
No, he's absolutely greatly right. Like, it's just not a bad thing, right?
Right.
But it was something where, you know, they had this great concert. People were, there was a lot of enthusiastic response around it. But all of the producers sort of fell off and didn't really follow up. Part of that reason was the sort of anti-communist sentiment in the United States at the time.
Okay.
But honestly, it also was because in 1933, there was a production of Threepenny that I believe only ran like 3 weeks. It was a terrible, terrible translation.
Oh gosh. Okay.
And also, you know, if you think about the United States in the 30s, it was quite hostile to socialism. Actually we had a Nazi problem as well. So it was really unsuccessful. And so a lot of producers were like, all right, well, between the current political climate and the evidence we have of an English translation of this, even though it wasn't Mark Blitzstein's work, people really backed off of it.
Okay.
You know, so that was why these two sort of nobody producers, right, managed to make it happen, because they were like, well, this is the shot we've got.
Right.
So this is what we're going to do.
So you've already sort of mentioned a couple of musicals that sort of took direct influence from Threepenny. And I'd say probably the big ones, the obvious ones that will openly tell you and recognize that they owe a lot to Threepenny Opera and the work of Bertolt Brecht, would be Cabaret and Urinetown that you mentioned. Can we talk a little bit about what are some of these shows, either Cabaret and Urinetown or some of the other ones, like you mentioned Pippin, what are they latching on to in Threepenny? What did Threepenny do so well and do so early on that other shows could then follow suit?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so Cabaret is a really interesting one, right? Because it takes place in the time when Threepenny was premiering, right? In the time and place in which it was premiering. You know, and a fun fact about the 1972 production of Cabaret is that La Dueña was in it.
Right, right.
And to add that like flavor, right? And that realism of it. So, you know, I think there is, and what Kurt Weill, the composer, was getting at, he sort of broke ground. So it's called the Threepenny Opera, right? And it's based on a 17th century opera. It's based on a 17th century opera called The Beggar's Opera, right? And that is a very traditionally what you would think of when you think of opera, classical music, that type of thing. He was making this opera that used atonality, that was borrowing from jazz, which he heard in the seedier nightclubs of Berlin, which is where Cabaret is set.
Okay. Right?
So it's almost like two, you know, it's like the Spider-Man meme. They're all pointing at each other.
Right.
You know, it's very much that. I mean, like there was so much, and you see it in these, even in the structure of Cabaret, right? The musical numbers are not all necessarily, you know, happening in a, okay, you know, in the traditional musical theater sense of like, I can't speak it, so I have to sing it, right? In a dramatic scene. Some of these numbers are actual just numbers in the nightclub, right? And there is direct address to the audience. And I think that's something that Cabaret Revival did so incredibly well, was the MC talking directly to the audience. And that is something that is like the Brechtian thing, but we'll get to Alienation.
But I guess we should also talk about there, at least for a time, there was a bootleg on YouTube of Alan Cumming doing the Threepenny Opera, who then would play the MC in the revival. So it's, again, it's one of those, like, having La Tolenia in the original cast, you know, you're doing like a little motion with your hands when you talk about Cabaret and Threepenny that the listeners won't be able to know about, but it's like, it's just this little cocoon and they're just feeding into each other. But you right off the bat, you talked about Urinetown. So I would love to know sort of, what are you seeing in Urinetown front that you think is a direct lineage to Threepenny?
Well, if you look at like the orchestrations of Threepenny, you know, there's a lot of doubling of like reeds and things like that. It's a smaller band, and the band is in view. There's also, you can also like, you know, just go back and listen to like the opening of Urinetown and then listen to the overture for Threepenny and like tell me it's not. You know, tell me it's not. But there is also a lot of direct address in the audience, to the audience there too, right? And I think this is the point at which we should bring up the V effect, right? The Alienation.
So talk to us a little bit about that.
So this is like, this is like what I think, you know, one of the elements of Brecht's work that's like best represented in Threepenny. It's this idea that so it's often mistranslated into the alienation effect, but it's really like the idea that a play should not cause the spectator to identify emotionally with the characters or the action, but that they should actually recognize that this is not real. So it's like sort of the opposite of suspending one's disbelief, right? It's like dropping the disbelief. And the idea is that it would provoke some self-reflection and a critical view of what's going on stage and therefore in the world. You know, Aristotle, that good old buddy, argued, you know, that catharsis sort of forced the audience to practice empathy. You know, if you really identify with the character, then you will have experienced, sort of walked a mile in their shoes, and you will have learned something from it, and it will improve society overall, right? What Brecht is saying is the opposite, is that when you get swept up in the story, you start getting attached to that particular character, and you don't actually think about the larger pieces at work. So the ways that he did this was, you know, reminding the spectator that the theater isn't real. So exposing pieces of the set, you know, holding up placards before every scene as if it's a silent movie to remind you that, you know, this isn't real. Direct address to the audience, speaking right out. Even as we were talking about the dissonant music, even that, it doesn't let you sit back and wash over you. You have to kind of sit up on your seat. And the idea, and you also don't get a happy ending, right? Or you get a happy ending that's sort of unsatisfactory and you don't believe it. Because he wanted the audiences to leave unsatisfied and recognize social injustice and exploitation and be moved to go out from the theater and do something about it because they were frustrated. They didn't get the satisfaction in the theater, right? So, you know, if you think about going back to Urinetown, like thinking about the end of Urinetown, he yelled, Officer Lockstock yells, Hail Malthus. Right. And so, you know, you've got a Broadway audience going like, who the heck is Malthus? Right. Everybody's looking it up after the show. And then everybody starts thinking about, like the usage of resources. Like, what is that? Right. And I think Urinetown is actually a really great example of this. Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, mute this right now. But, you know, but you have, you know, the characters kind of do get what they want. And it's not good for the world. You know, this idea that like, oh, well, if everybody has the water, then everybody actually dies. That's actually a bad thing, right? It makes us as an audience feel uncomfortable and go, oh, where have I done that in my life, right? But he also, you know, Brecht also did this in Threepenny, this alienation with McKeith. Like in the 54 production in the United States, the McKeith was directed to be more effeminate, so that this idea of a murderer, this like hyper masculine ideal, and then this characterization that is seems to be bucking up against that, right? Lotta Lenya at playing Pirate Jenny when she originated the role in 1929. Now in 1954, she's still playing it, and the idea of like the most desired prostitute is one who is much older, right? The idea that, you know, so sort of forcing people to start to address like, oh, why do I think that's dissonant?
Okay.
Why do I think, you know, a man who gives some effeminate characteristics can't murder? What is that? Why do I think violence is masculine? Right. So the idea is that you are getting at truth and not necessarily reality. And I think that's a very important thing to highlight, especially in the culture in which we live right now. You know, like to understand that reality is not the same thing as truth, right? As an actor, the reality is that you're on a stage. You have to cheat out, right? You have to project your voice. Can you still give a performance that feels true and resonates with people? Abso-freaking-lutely, right?
And so you're hitting so much on these big ideas that are so integral to Brecht's philosophy, to really Brecht's major contributions to the theater that we still see popping up in so many different ways, you know, not to harken back to just this one production, but the Alan Cumming production of Three Penny, they used like neon signs that would lower down and say, we're in Mac's den now, or, you know, or we're in Peachum's parlor, that there is no set piece. They're just telling you this is where this scene takes place. We see so many ideas like that still going on in theater. Would you recommend for listeners, are there other works of Bertolt Brecht that you feel like highlight this philosophy just as well as Three Penny or better than Three Penny? Or would you say that Three Penny is a really good starting place to start grappling with this idea?
That's a great question. Well, firstly, you know, something I'm sorry I haven't brought up sooner is that Brecht didn't do this alone. This was not Brecht's alone. And I want to do a little justice here to Elizabeth Hauptmann, who was his, he dated all of his collaborators. Elizabeth Hauptmann was his girlfriend and initially brought him the material for Three Penny Opera, wrote the majority of it, you know, borrowed, you know, other language from a criminal poet named François Villon, you know, and she was also the one who gave him Das Kapital and introduced him to Marxism.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and she was not really, she was listed as a co-writer, but not really given a whole lot of credit for the work. And she wrote the book for Happy End, which is another Brecht-Weill collab that I highly recommend checking out. She wrote the book for that, but it was nominated for a Tony for it, but 6 years after her death. So she never really in her lifetime got to see, you know, her work shine. But Happy End is a great one. I would say also Caucasian Chalk Circle and Mother Courage, you know, are also, and it's interesting because, you know, I wouldn't call those musicals, those last two necessarily musicals. I would call them plays with music. But I still think that there is a very interesting sensibility there, that if people want to try to understand this, you know, Verfremdungseffekt, this V effect, this, you know, alienation effect, I think those are great places to look. But I also think we see it in our culture now. Meme culture is a really good example of that alienation effect.
Great. Say more.
Oh boy. Where do I start? Okay. So, you know, I think there is, you know, sort of a lack of straightforwardness to the humor of meme culture. And sometimes it's so Dadaist and random mm-hmm. that it almost comes back around to being in earnest, you know? The memes, I do feel, you know, so many people I've spoken to have gotten a better understanding about, a piece of music or piece of political theory or anything from a joke being made in a meme, because it doesn't give you all of the information, right? Uh-huh. It's just the image, and then you have to go into it. But the meme itself, right, is not an original piece, right? It's almost uh-huh. always using imagery that was created by somebody else, or is a stock photo, or, you know, a screen cap from a movie, right? So again, we're coming back to that Spider-Man pointing, all the Spider-Mans pointing at each other, right?
Okay.
Where does the idea start? And is the idea living in the meme itself? Or is it, you know, something that originated with one person a long time ago? Right. And I don't know if there is necessarily a new idea, right? Is there anything like that? But I think there's a lot in Threepenny that speaks to our culture right now. I mean, the alienation that one feels in the current pandemic that we live in, right? The alienation of being separated from everybody and yet being more connected as a culture than we ever have been. Mm. You know, we have we have somehow created this, you know, situation where we have like 17 apps to communicate with each other, but we feel more alone than ever before.
So if you had to address Threepenny tomorrow, if you had to direct it, if you were cast in it, if you were producing it, what would be the thoughts in the forefront of your mind? Like, what are you trying to bring the audience's attention to within the production if you were presenting it tomorrow or next week?
Well, number one, I would want to do the entire thing on TikTok.
Oh, cool. Okay.
I think that, the accessibility of Threepenny is mm-hmm. what I think makes it so compelling. But I think it's a long runtime. It's like 2.5 hours, you know, right, like right. I think that our, I would be interested to see what it would be like to play with attention spans and make people uncomfortable in the context of TikTok, which feels like a very comfortable thing to do, right? It's feeding, we just can constantly scroll to the point where the TikTok algorithm actually every once in a while will be like, hey, you're scrolling too fast.
Right.
So, yeah. Right. Right. But I also would focus on the war song.
Which is a great song.
Incredible song. I mean, talk about a Stein swinger, you know, like it's mm-hmm. a real banger. And I think that, that was sort of the turning point for audiences in 1929. The audiences in Berlin didn't really get it until they got to the war song, which features a career criminal and the chief of police reminiscing on their happy days in the army. And then they were like, oh, we get what's going on here. Yes, they're all the same thing, right? The call is coming from inside the house.
A Spider-Man pointing at each other. There we go.
Spider-Man's pointing at each other, right? Like, this is all systemic, you know? And I think that when we look at the militarization of our modern police right now, I think the war song is, about as much of a, defund the police, abolish the police anthem as anything else, right? Mm. Because it's talking about how really the laws only apply if you don't have friends.
Which is then just so frustrating that, you know, someone wrote this back in the 20s or multiple mm-hmm. people wrote this and could recognize this back in the 20s. And yet we're still having this conversation. We're still needing to have people realize this and make this click, which is a little bit crazy.
It is a little bit crazy. But, you know, also I think that, you know, history is not a line. It's a spiral, right? Mm. We like circle in on it a little bit closer every time. I think that, when you look at the crisis, you know, because lots of people love to like compare, you know, Weimar era Berlin to, you know, what's happening in our country now, especially during the Trump years, you know, and I think that's a really overly simplistic way to view things. But I will say there is a large gap between rich and poor right now. We have massive systemic inequality, but we also have the leisure time and the resources to be reading up on Marxist theory and materialist feminist theory and like all of these things. You know, I think that there is a similarity in the way that ideas are being able to be forged right now. And there's an excitement. And it, you know, I think that that is, I think that's what makes Threepenny so evergreen, is because it really is like a cry against, you know. I like to refer to Bertolt Brecht as sort of a Kanye figure, because he really only wrote things as a contrarian response to someone else. He had to have an enemy. He had to have beef in order to write something, you know. And this is like his, you know, this was his first major hit, you know. And at the time, you know, we talk about Brecht so much right now, but at the time, Brecht was incredibly jealous of Vile, because his music was the one that was playing in all of the clubs. There was even a club that only played Threepenny Opera music.
Wow.
Yeah, like, and Brecht was mad that he couldn't find a way to make his ideas as catchy as the music is, which is why I feel like this piece lends itself well to TikToks, because TikToks and memes and internet culture in general has made ideas catchy.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It has and made ideas.
Let's
viral.
Talk about catchy. Let's talk about Bobby Darin covering Mac the Knife, you know, which is crazy to take this song that, as you've mentioned, like, we got discord, we got dissonance. It's supposed to make you uncomfortable. And we've got, you know, top 50 Billboard hit. Yeah. Crazy that that song can become popular in the right hands, because it is. It's so catchy. This music is dangerous.
Yes, it's very dangerous. And here's the thing about Bobby Darin, which I love. So Bobby Darin was the one who took home the 1959 Grammy for Record of the Year. But Louis Armstrong was the first one to cover it.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah. So, and Louis Armstrong was, you know, giving it a lot of the subtext of, you know, being on the other side of oppression in this country, right? As much as he could at the time, right? But, you know, he did, you know, he did, like, Bobby Darin did, like, give Louis Armstrong like a little up in the song itself, like added sort of contemporary ad libs and and like Armstrong had this sort of playful tribute to La Delenia in the lyrics, right? Which then Bobby Darin copied, and then Ella Fitzgerald's live recording won a Grammy a year later. You know, and she, at the time, like in the introduction, she says something like, oh God, I hope I remember all of the lyrics. And she forgets them. And she does a live improvisation that includes lyrics, oh, Bobby Darin and Louis Armstrong, they made a record. Oh, but they did. And now Ella and her fellas were making a wreck. What a wreck of Mac the Knife.
Oh
So again, we got Spider-Man all pointing at each other.
There we go. And listeners, if you want to talk more about these pop artists covering musical theater songs, definitely I'm going to give a little plug. Give a listen to the My Fair Lady episode with Peter Felicia. He goes in depth. All these names that we're mentioning now, like, they were all covering My Fair Lady. They were all covering Hello, Dolly. So it is, we're keeping Three Penny like right in line with these big mainstream hits that were playing uptown concurrently. So I'd love to ask Lauren, in your opinion, because I'll get a little bit personal here, and I'll say that I found Three Penny Opera because as like a little kid, I got my hands somewhere on an album that is Bea Arthur doing just whatever the heck she wanted to do. She's like, you know, at death's door, so old, sitting in a chair, and she's just singing whatever she wants to sing. And for whatever reason, this old lady was like, I want to do Pirate Jenny. I want to sing Pirate Jenny in my like farewell concert, which is crazy, which is weird. And she sings it and she gives minimal context leading up to it. And then she sings this very scary song, like you already sort of summarized for us about, you know, the most desirable prostitute kind of having a dark side to her. Yeah. And it's very scary, and out of context, it's crazy that this woman sang that. So that sort of led me to Three Penny Opera. So I'd love to ask, for someone who wanted more traditional of an approach, maybe wanted a little more context than finding that song, how would you recommend a listener who doesn't know Three Penny Opera but is interested? Should they be reading it? Is there a recording that you'd recommend? There's more than one movie. What would you say is the best in to Three Penny Opera?
Ooh, honestly, that's a really good question. I think, like any piece, but especially this piece, the way in is to do it, is to go try and learn Pirate Jenny, and sing her words and feel that. Because, you know, we talk so much about this alienation effect, and I think sometimes people mistake that for not having a deep connection to the piece and to the character. And, you know, that song that Pirate Jenny sings, Pirate Jenny, is really about sexual violence. It's about her taking revenge on all of the people who have hurt her, right? To do the work, to me, is to start to approach it. I would also say, like, haunting covers are, you know, Nina Simone's, and Bob Dylan actually wrote, he said he was laid quote flat on his back by the translation of the ship The Black Freighter, and composed in that style, and then wrote When the Ship Comes In. So I think the way to get into this piece is to find your personal emotional hook into it. Because I think that, you know, if you try and approach it like a traditional musical where you might like go like listen to the OBC and, you know, try and imagine what the production might be like. I think without the visual aspect, without the felt experience of it, it can sometimes feel inaccessible. And you're like, sort of like, why is this so, you know, all over the place and atonal, and this is making me mad. But it's about the feeling, right? So to me, it's experiencing the piece to me. But also, I would recommend if you can get your hands on a recording of the Berliner Ensemble's productions, especially the one they did a few years ago was just so arresting and stark. But I honestly would say the best way is to either do it or get in the theater and experience it live, like if you can.
And so is this a show that, did you meet this show in that way? Were you able to see it live, or were you able to work on it?
I college production, you know,
was
the hook in. And I was just doing, you know, ensemble, but I couldn't stop, you know, like the Ballad of Dependency. I would just sit backstage every night and just be so enraptured by this like dark, really toxic relationship and like how, you know, how like sexy and alive it was at the same time, you know, but it was the presence, honestly. And it was having to pick apart this work and go, okay, how do we still make this feel relevant? You know, and turns out, you know, the more you approach the work, the more you do the work, the more you're like, oh wow, this all is happening right now. There is nothing I need to do to make it relevant, you know.
I'll say this is a very different show, I think, than some of the other episodes. When I'm talking to people, one of the things that comes up is, you know, the Fantastics springs to mind. And it's like, this is a hard show to do wrong. Like, you can go see this show in like an amateur production with no budget in the basement of the church, and you're going to have the best night you've ever had at the theater. It is hard to screw up the Fantastics. Yeah. I would not say that about the Three Penny Opera. I would say that there's a lot of delicacy in the mix here. While we're talking about how much is relevant, how much we can see in it that still resonates today, it is so easy to like place a concept on top of this and really drive any nuance into the ground and just make this sort of like heavy-handed and preachy. So I'd love to know, like, dramaturgically, coming at a different sort of listener now who maybe is listening and knows Three Penny inside out and is preparing to mount a production at their college, in the basement of a church, on Broadway, whatever. What would you say dramaturgically, like, what would you say to that person? What should they be thinking about? What should they be engaging with?
For me, I think I see a lot of concept Three Penny productions in the in the way that, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to do Hamlet, but on the moon, you know,
yes,
like
I've seen some of those as well.
Yes. And I think that like that sort of is like a way of trying to like skate around the to make it more palatable to an audience and be like, oh well, I don't want to alienate people, we need those subscribers, which capitalism, all right, like
right.
Let's talk about it. But I think I want to just read this quote because I feel like it says everything we need to say.
Oh great.
Mark Blitstein saw an original production in Berlin when he was a student, so decades before he translated it and made it into the, you know, Broadway hit we know today. As a kid he saw it, and he described Brecht's style as, quote, daringly anti-Aristotelian. It rejects atmospheric or emotional persuasion, audience involvement, audience catharsis. It demands floodlit exploration, unsentimental demonstration, audience estrangement, final audience realization. Set forth as a concept, this may seem forbiddingly cold, but so intense is the Brechtian energy, so varied the ingenuity, so deep the insight and compassion, and so unerring the sense of human comedy that in actual reading, and certainly in a good performance, the play takes on a quality of an intellectual circus.
Wow.
That, I know. So, like, I would say focus on, you know, I think we as musical students of musical theater, as lovers of musical theater, we unironically love things because they are sentimental, right? But here you have to be vicious. You have to be like Mac the Knife. You have to be able to say, I don't really care if you don't get it. Because that's the magic of Three Penny, is saying like, I don't care if you get it, but I'm also at the same time addressing you directly and saying, come along, right? If you're brave enough, come with me, right? But I think that's something that we sort of miss in audience interaction nowadays at all. And I'm not talking about like, you know, the moment in the finale where everybody like, you know, walks into the audience, like, please God, don't do that. I think there's an Onion article or something about like, oh God, they're coming into the audience.
Okay.
Beautiful. But you know, I think there is sort of a attitude we have towards the audience now that is sort of like us and them in the theater, you know. I think we have this attitude of like, oh, well, if people can't stay off their phones, they shouldn't come to the theater, instead of figuring out how we can integrate phones into the theatrical experience, you know, instead of wondering why that's more interesting to them.
Right.
Yeah.
There is this incredible book that I recommend to everyone. So I'm going to recommend it to you, and I'm going to recommend it to the listeners as well. And I'm checking the title. It's over here next to me. It's called Theater and Audience by Helen Freshwater. It's like, it's like a read it in like two or three sittings. It's a very small book. But her whole thing is she'll change the way you go into every theater now, because basically she says, like, if the artistic director or whoever comes out and is saying, we want everyone sitting forward, we want you engaging with the work. She's basically like, fuck you. Fuck you. Don't tell me what to do. And she goes into all these experimental theater pieces that are incorporating like video game mentality and all these different things. It totally revolutionized. And I would say I was already a person who, you know, who was introduced to Brecht like formally in college, was familiar with the VFX, like new stuff like this. So when I'm in the audience, I'm feel like I am already consciously thinking about theater and audience relationship. I've read through this book so many times, and it totally changed the way that I enter a theater space and think about my relationship to the performers as an audience member, just because it hits on everything that you just talked about. It hits on so much that came from that quote.
Well, and I love that you say this, because the form is the function, right? And the thing I would say to producers of this work is, if you're doing Three Penny and the seats are, you know, $100 a pop, and you don't have lower prices for younger people or for, you know, anybody who can't afford it, because let's be honest, there are people who are in their like mid-30s and 40s who can't afford, you know, like if you're making this work inaccessible and treating it as a treasured classic with which we cannot mess, you know, then you are missing the point of Three Penny Opera. To me, the way you put on a production and the way you run your theater company is what shows up in the artistic product on stage. And if you are, you know, doing a thing, you know, if like we're seeing with a lot of, you know, a lot of folks now where, you know, we see you, we hear you, you know, and we all know what I'm talking about. But I mean, even, you know, looking at pay transparency, there is a really great newsletter by Lauren Halverson called Nothing for the Group, which I love and everybody should read. But in it, she at the bottom always has a posting of current jobs in the American theater. Like, let's say, you know, your literary manager, your, you know, AD, whatever. And then and the salary. And then next to it, what you need to make in that city in order to live what we would call above the poverty line.
Okay. Wow.
Right. So if you're doing Three Penny, but you're not paying your interns, I don't have time for you.
Right.
Like, and Brecht will, you know, like come haunt you. I promise.
Perfect.
You
know,
but I think that there is something about, you know, these large scale productions that just don't recognize also like what one must do for the community. You know, I think a Three Penny where the cast on their day off goes and volunteers is one that I would like to see, you know.
And would you say some of those things that you've just thrown out there, you know, like a Three Penny that is paying their interns a living wage or they're volunteering on their day off, would you say you have any examples in mind of people who today are sort of on like carrying on this legacy of Brecht and Weill and Hauptmann, and are sort of living what they're putting on stage? Do you have any examples of a group or an individual, a theater that's doing this now?
Oh yeah. Oh, how many people can I name? Yes. I mean, like, I want to draw attention because we talked a little bit earlier about, the form follows the function, right? The way we make theater is what shows up on the stage. So I just want to shout out quickly a couple of organizations and people that I think are really shifting the conversation right now. And, you know, Broadway for Racial Justice, the Broadway Advocacy Coalition, Natalie Randall, Shakina Nafak, Brandon Michael Nays, Davon Williams, and Davon Williams in particular for pushing forward the Black Theater Matters bill, which was a bill in equity that is, and I know that, there might be a, wait, well, this is a lot of, why you got to make it about race? And it's like, well, let me tell you about the Black Theater Matters bill. So the Black, that actually has materially changed some things. It's putting forward, I mean, there's discussions happening right now about like whether or not a 10 out of 12 is a thing we should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, is that useful for everybody? Why are technicians not allowed in the rehearsal room until that moment? Right? Mm. Like, why is it that there's only one day off a week? You know, I think the pandemic really forced us to address why we say the show must go on. And whether or not that is I think we can all agree it's not healthy. But like, does the work benefit or is it detracted by those backstage attitudes?
Mm.
Right. And there's so many other folks. I mean, the Kilroys release a list of plays by people of marginalized genders. You can check out, and all of them are unproduced, by the way. These are all plays that have not yet gotten airtime on a stage. The Cornerstone Theater Company doing projects to, you know, go out into the world and create theater in towns where there isn't a theater. They build a proper theater for folks. And then that, you know, just leaving theaters in their wake and teaching a community how to create a space. I think anybody who is, I think we can talk about, New York, New York, New York, and it's like the center of the theatrical world. But I honestly feel like the real revolutionaries out there are the folks in Lexington, Kentucky, the folks in Columbus, Ohio, the folks who are making theater that isn't, getting these awards or a ton of the, even funding that we get from the NEA. I think the more we can, anybody who is advocating for live streaming production so that folks with disabilities or people who are geographically unable to come to the theater can enjoy it. And I think we've seen by now that it's not that, because the argument is always like, then people won't want to come to the theater. They will have already seen the show. But what I've actually been noticing is that it makes people hungrier to see it in person when they have the ability to. Like, now I've gotten a taste and I really want to see it again. I think anybody who is leveraging technology and not, old man screaming at clouding about it, anything that is going to make the theater something that is for everyone and a place that is a center for community and to have a conversation instead of a dark room where you go in, you are talked to or at for a couple of hours, and then you go out and go, oh, I feel so cultured.
Which these are great. These are awesome. And it's exactly, it's picking up Brecht's work, who had audience coming into the rehearsal room, who was really going to the fundamental things that were in place and saying, is this important? Do we need this? Or can we throw this out the window? So that's amazing. That's an awesome list. Thank you so much for sharing all that. Is there any work? Is there any person? Is there any theater group that you would say sort of, because I think we can say that Bertolt Brecht had his own aesthetic, had his own philosophy kind of like to the max in all of his art. Would you say there's anyone who's sort of carrying on that legacy and thinking along those lines? I know that's also like a hard question to just sort of throw out there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, and again, I'm going to have to go back and look.
Yeah.
But the scenic designer for the current run of Company. There obviously I could point to people like, you know, that are much bigger names, but this person, and God, I really wish I could find the name. You know what?
Go for it. We'll edit this part out. Yeah.
Fabulous. Thank you.
No worries.
Oh my gosh. Come on. This is one of my... yes. Okay. All right. So somebody I can speak to is Bunny Christie, who did the costumes and the scenic design for the current production of Company on Broadway. And also did the set for a play called People, Places, Things, which is about somebody who is going through withdrawals. And there is this incredible moment, and they sort of do this trick in Company as well, where the main character lies down in bed, and then the same person in another costume enters a door, and then another person runs to the bathroom and throws up. So it's all multiple actors, but they're all dressed exactly the same. And so it's the idea of all of this time passing, right? That is actually being condensed into like maybe a 1 to 2 minute sequence.
Oh, cool.
And this is directly Brechtian, right? So like this idea of, and you know, the film montage is the same concept, right? Picasso's use of sort of collaging cubism, right? All of that is very similar to what Brecht was doing, right? It wasn't observing Aristotle's unities of time, right? It's sort of breaking time in order to show you that time is, you know, as we are fond of saying now, a construct and a flimsy one at that, right? I think that there's something very arresting about that work that sort of forces the audience to go, wait, what? And at the same time, it feels like a magic trick and you're totally enraptured by how it's happening, even though you can see, you're watching it live. It can't all be the same person.
Right.
So you're seeing behind the curtain at the same time as you're seeing this beautiful illusion and metaphor for time. So to me, that is about as VFX as you can get. It's arresting and you're pulled in, and at the same time you're like, well, what is time? That is wild. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that sounds very... Thank you for painting that picture for us. Thank you. That was amazing.
My pleasure.
And thank you so much for talking with me today about the Threepenny Opera.
This was fabulous. It's my pleasure. Thank you so very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us today. Please make sure to purchase a copy of 50 Key Stage Musicals by visiting Routledge.com or by clicking in today's show description. If you want to learn more about the Threepenny Opera, please also review the links in the below description. I'm Andrew Child, and thank you for listening to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.